maybe 30 or 20 years ago, a Saudi might have said, I'm Muslim and I'm Arab and I'm Saudi. Now they might say, I'm Saudi and I'm Arab and I'm Muslim.
You know, they're trying to radically refashion their country and they need help from the best experts in the world. Do you want to have your country's people be disqualified from that because of some essentially antiquated point of view about how countries work together?
In recent months, it can feel like Saudi Arabia is intent on buying the world. It's bought up much of golf, sports teams, many of the globe's best soccer players to its own domestic league, and it owns huge chunks of many of the biggest companies on the planet. But Saudi Arabia is not just on a shopping spree. The once insular, oil-rich kingdom is transforming into a major diplomatic and military player, a pivotal actor in the energy transition, and looks set to host high-end cultural events like the FIFA World Cup.
You know, they know that buying a football club immediately brings you a billboard into a global game that allows you to completely reposition yourself and rebrand yourself.
It feels like we're entering the era of the Saudi project. But what exactly is the kingdom trying to achieve, and will it succeed? Coming soon from Intelligence Squared, The Saudi Project is a new podcast series seeking to answer some of these questions and more.
Britain does have choices. It's not either-or situation. We either indulge Mohammed bin Salman or boycott Mohammed bin Salman. There is a third choice.
Search The Saudi Project wherever you get your podcasts.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. With the looming threat of military conflict currently on the horizon in Ukraine, today we're joined by Mark Galliotti to discuss the constantly evolving nature of modern warfare. Conventional conflict fought with guns, bombs, and soldiers is a horror visited upon the world all too often, but it's also expensive to wage and often unpopular at home. So nations have innovated. Russia wages hybrid warfare on Ukraine. The US threatens Iran with sanctions. China spends billions buying political influence abroad. And the world seems to be heading for a new era of permanent low-level conflict, often unnoticed, undeclared, and seemingly unending. Our guest today is Mark Galliotti, honorary professor at UCL and a specialist in politics, criminology, security studies, international relations, and anthropology. His recent book, The Weaponization of Everything, is a groundbreaking survey of these new ways of waging war. Joining Mark to discuss the book is Carl Miller, research director of the Center for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos. Here's Carl with more.
I am really, really delighted to welcome our guest today, Mark Galliotti. He's an honorary professor at UCL, SSEES, which I'm sure he'll explain, and senior associate at the Royal United Services Institute. Many of you will probably know him for his earlier publishing on transnational crime and Russia security affairs. He's written books including The Vory and We Need to Talk About Putin. And he's here to talk with me about, and all of you, about his new book, The Weaponization of Everything, A Field Guide to the New Way of War. Mark, very, very warm welcome to you.
Oh, great to be here.
So, A Field Guide to the New Way of War, your book. Let's begin, Mark, with what you're saying is not happening anymore. Conventional war, hot war. What's leaving the world as we know it today?
Well, I mean, it's not leaving the world totally, unfortunately. I mean, if we look now at the events that are taking place on the Ukrainian border, the prospect of good old-fashioned shooting war hasn't disappeared. But they're becoming much, much less common. I mean, this is one of the striking things. There are various academic centers that track the number of wars, the casualties of wars, and so forth. And what they're finding is that although there's still a lot of civil wars, unfortunately, we still do seem to like murdering our cousins, but interstate wars, those old-fashioned sorts, the ones that are declared, fought, ending with a peace treaty or whatever else, they're actually much, much less common. And there's a whole variety of reasons for that, ranging from the fact that war has become eye-wateringly expensive. The military types like to use the term exquisite, you know, exquisite capabilities. But of course, exquisite capabilities is actually another way of just simply saying ridiculously expensive and often, frankly, not very usable. If you take all the fighters that were in RAF Fighter Command during the Battle of Britain and price them up and turn them into today's money, you can buy six of the new F-35 planes that we're getting. And these are obviously phenomenally capable planes, but still just six of them. And remember, one of them fell off an aircraft carrier the other day. So, you know, on the one hand, wars become really expensive in economic terms, but it's also become expensive in political terms. Populations now are much, much less willing, even within authoritarian regimes, to accept boys coming home in boxes as a price of empire. And also in terms of we now have international law and we also have interconnected economies, which means that when you fight, you are also often probably destroying your own markets, your own suppliers and such like. So I think for all these reasons, that's what's going away to an extent. There will always be, unfortunately, some of the old-fashioned wars, but they're just becoming much, much less, shall we say, appealing for our world's leaders to fight.
And does that mean, Mark, that we are skipping into a world of kind of bucolic universal peace, or perhaps your book might be suggesting that there is another kind of conflict, which is taking centre stage instead?
Quite. Well, where would we authors be if we were heading into that realm? No, I mean, it would be delightful if it were so, but I suspect anyone can open a newspaper or fire up Twitter and very quickly see that that is definitely not the case. No, because all the various pressures that have existed between states, between blocs and so forth, they haven't gone away. We still have all kinds of rivalries. And in some ways, they have been liberated by the end of the Cold War. You know, we think of the Cold War as a period of relative peace, admittedly one enforced by the threat of thermonuclear Armageddon. But actually, the Cold War was a period of relative peace in the Northern Hemisphere. And part of that was exactly, we just simply exported all our conflicts. The Cold War was not a time of peace if you're in Afghanistan or Angola, Nicaragua or Vietnam. But now, well, we have no more of those kind of controlling instruments. We have so many more rivalries, and actually now we absolutely can engage in rivalries with other countries around the world. But that goes in different directions. If we're not going to be fighting wars with them, if we're not going to be sending the gunboats, how else can we prosecute those conflicts? And so I think that's really what's changing, is that we are in an age where those conflicts are still there, but they're now being waged by a whole variety of different means.
And before we go any further, we're going to have to broach that kind of tricky topic for us researchers, you know, definitions. And for those, you know, perhaps not part of this world, it is worth saying that a whole kind of subgenre of kind of event and kind of analyst has stepped in, haven't they, Mark, over the last kind of 5 years to kind of look at this emergence. You know, and there's a whole kind of universe of words like hybrid warfare and the grey zone and asymmetric conflict and so on. How do you kind of navigate this somewhat kind of molten vocabulary to try and make sense of all of it?
Largely with Olympian contempt. I mean, the problem is that so much of this is also driven by, and again, we also know this, you know, within the realm of academe, there is a premium on coming up with a new concept. And then you become the researcher du jour until someone else comes up with another one. So, for example, take this notion of hybrid war, which is generally defined as a conflict which is fought with a mix of kinetic, otherwise shooting, and non-kinetic means. Well, the problem with that is that every war since the dawn of conflict has been hybrid. It's only in video games that you win a war by killing all the other person's soldiers. In practice, wars are always fought on the level of morale, will, and in some ways just simply determination to keep fighting. So you're always trying to just simply undermine the enemy's will to resist. So, you know, hybrid war doesn't really work. A lot of these others, asymmetric war and such like. Grey zone, you mentioned, I mean, that's the best. Because it's almost like, we admit we have no idea what to call it, but we need to call it something. So let's call it something like this. There will no doubt be something else coming along next year. And this actually does, I'm glad you raised it, because it really speaks to an important question, which is precisely the extent to which we become victims, trapped by our own definitions. And in this respect, I think that we have to come to terms with the fact that we're going to need to redefine or redevelop or just re-understand our terms, like war and peace. I mean, we are at peace at the moment, aren't we? Well, we think so. Except, of course, that we have troops currently in a sort of, you know, showdown on the eastern flank of NATO. But also we have a constant challenge of disinformation, of cyber attacks and so forth. Are those acts of war? Are those just the static of international competition? This is the point. We have no definitions for these kind of new contests at the moment. And so rather than just trying to kind of layer on some new term, you know, non-linear war. That's another one that I really love because, again, what on earth does that actually mean? Instead of just simply trying to find some new bolt-on term, we should actually understand that the whole concept of warfare is changing. So it's the ideas behind it, not the word that needs to be done, addressed.
Okay, well, let's jump into the grey zone. And one of the things, Mark, that I loved so much about your book, actually, were these kind of vignettes where you really, I mean, each chapter and section kind of bring that conflict to life in a really kind of concrete, specific way. How about you take us into one of those and kind of explain what the grey zone and conflict within it and warfare now in its extended and ubiquitous form, what that really looks like?
Well, the thing about grey zone, for example, that term, it's one that has been generated by the military, particularly came from the US military, because they decided they didn't like hybrid and they were looking for a new term. And so it's defined really very much in the sense of something that accompanies war fighting. So yes, there's soldiers doing their thing, but then there's also cyber attacks or whatever. What I think is really interesting is when one looks at the situations where the non-military means replace the actions of soldiers. I mean, for example, you know, one example that I do use in the book is of lawfare, the use of law in some ways as a weapon. And it relates to this Russian cargo ship that was taking embargoed weapons all the way around Europe and the UK to Syria to support the very unpleasant regime of Bashar al-Assad that was busy suppressing his own people exceedingly bloodily. Now, there were all kinds of sanctions and embargoes placed upon such military trade, but the ship was being cunning enough to not move within territorial waters. And, you know, when one thinks of the instruments that could be used, you know, you think, oh, well, we can send in the special boat service to seize it or whatever. No, I mean, what happened is, and I think it was actually a brilliant move, is instead Her Majesty's government turned to the insurance industry. After all, Lloyd's of London, the centre for the world's maritime insurance, is, as you gather, in London. And they just simply had a word with the company that was involved in insuring this ship and just simply said, you know, you do realize that this is likely to be involved in embargo breaking, which actually would seem to be in, you know, invalidating the clauses of the insurance. And they said, yes, you're right, either because they were convinced or because, frankly, when HMG wants to speak to you on an issue like this, it's worth listening. They pulled the insurance. And although that might not sound like much, actually, having an uninsured cargo ship on the high waters is a very big deal indeed. So what happened is the ship turned around and went home. Not a shot was fired. No secret agent was involved. It was actually just by manipulating, I mean, of all things, my apologies to any listeners who happen to work in the insurance industry. But, you know, what could sound more boring than manipulating the insurance industry to ensure that you force another country to not break your rules and do something to help try and stop some of the bloodiest actions that are taking place in a civil war in Syria. That was conflict, whether we like it or not, and we found ways of moving it into the new realm. So I think this is it. Grey zone is in some ways a simple way of defining this imaginative use of all the other instruments at our disposal to impose our will upon other states. And sometimes it's going to be economic sanctions, sometimes it's going to be the use of international alliances, and sometimes it's going to be in the use of the insurance industry, as in this case. But the point is, these are ways that are unconventional, and they take advantage of the way in the new world we are all so interconnected and interdependent.
Let's dwell on this, Mark, because I think this raises a kind of excellent kind of secondary theme for us to touch on, which is exactly what kinds of states and actors might be gaining power through the emergence of these kinds of techniques. Now, it seems to me anyway that certainly within Whitehall, there's a great deal of anxiety about the emergence of hybrid conflict and the grey zone. especially with disinformation, information warfare, I guess there's this narrative which is happening within government that, oh, this is something which autocrats are better at than democracies, and the kind of all the advantages that democracies have had around, you know, conventional military overmatch are somehow being eroded through conflict finding these new forms. But the example you gave, and perhaps financial warfare too, as another one, seems to imply that actually there's plenty of power for large, prosperous Western democracies in conflicts which don't necessarily have anything to do with conventional militaries.
Absolutely. It's all too easy to go the sort of the route that says, oh my God, it's all of a sudden the other guys, the bad guys, who actually have the advantage here. And there is some truth in that, in part because other countries, and particularly if we look at who, you know, who have been regarded as the key users of this, you know, Russia, Iran, North Korea, China, they have often been in positions where they are the weaker, certainly in terms of the conventional old forms of power. And therefore, they exactly have to think like good global sort of geopolitical guerrillas. How can they move the battle away from where their enemies are stronger and towards where either they're stronger or at least the enemy is weaker? So yes, that's perfectly true. But in some ways, it just simply has meant that their weakness has been a spur to the imagination. To a degree, we got fat and lazy. Because precisely, we had economic power, we had military power, we had technological power, we had soft power, the power of example. So we seem to be on the top of the heap. Why did we need to change? Now we're finding it out. And this is, I mean, at the risk of sounding like a real creep, I mean, I think one of the things that came out really well in your book, The Death of the Gods, is precisely this sense of a whole concept of what power is shifting. And it doesn't mean that the old forms of power just go away. It just simply means that they're now supplemented or rivaled by a whole new variety. So, you know, yes, it's in a position in which a country like Russia, that has, for a start, a very, very strong tradition, actually, of hacking, that, you know, goes back to the early 90s and to an extent into the late 80s, can harness that as a weapon. But yeah, it certainly doesn't mean that we are weak. And in some ways, it's because we have decided to think that certain things don't count as warfare. I mean, when we level economic sanctions on a country, we are engaging in economic warfare, whether we're willing to use that language or not. And again, part of the purpose of the book is just simply to say, look, this is the way the world is getting. Let's just be honest about it and let's just talk about it. So yes, we have all kinds of advantages. We have economic power, technological edges. One of the reasons why the Russians are more able to mess with us with cyber is because they're willing to do it. It's not actually that GCHQ, the NSA, and various other Western agencies do not have the capacity to do so. It's just that they have not been given, and I'm glad to say, they have not been given the political say-so to crash the computers running, for example, Russia's railway grid. It should have a tremendously serious impact, given that that moves most of the food that goes to Russian cities. You know, things like that. We do have those capabilities. So, yes, this is not about a council of despair. It's too easy to go that route. And yes, you can get a really kind of headline chasing book if you write that one that says everything's terrible and the bad guys are winning. But that's not how the world really is.
Absolutely. Absolutely right, Mike. Couldn't agree more. And sometimes it is very important as analysts and writers to push back against a kind of mono narrative of the internet destroying everything or anything destroying everything. But let's talk about new relationships. So what are the kind of new relationships which have formed in this in the murky world of the gray zone? You know, the intersection between, say, organized crime and intelligence agencies, I think, is an absolutely fascinating one that I know you've looked at.
Yeah, well, if I can actually just pull the aperture back. I mean, again, this is one of the interesting things. Nowadays, in the modern world, you know, we basically no longer have the old style ideological divide between the socialist bloc and the capitalist bloc, even though that was always a little bit of a sort of hazy one. We are in many ways in a post-ideological age. And therefore, we actually find a whole variety of different actors getting involved in what in the book I call gig geopolitics. That actually a lot of it is outsourced, precisely. And in some cases, it's outsourced to gangsters, and sometimes it's outsourced to lawyers. So just pick those two examples, because, of course, there is absolutely no connection between the two. I mean, gangsters, you know, we have seen, again, there are examples one can point to in the past, particularly during World War II, but it was a relatively rare thing. Now, actually, it's becoming increasingly routine for, and again, here the Russians, I think, very much led the way, in part precisely because of the very incestuous relationship, to be perfectly honest, between organized crime and organized power in both Yeltsin's and Putin's Russias, where, you know, we see that clearly the intelligence agencies do outsource particular operations to them, or even more interestingly, that they tax them. They turn to gangsters and say, look, we know what you're doing. We're not going to get in your way. However, in return, we will expect you to kick a certain amount of your profits to this particular bank account in Switzerland or Liechtenstein or Latvia or wherever. The Russians had this term, Chornaya Kassa, black accounts. In other words, monies that doesn't seem to have any kind of Kremlin fingerprints on it, but which they can then use for political subversion operations, backing a, you know, an extremist website here, a particular radical political party there, that kind of thing. So, you know, gangsters get used for anything from that all the way up to assassination. We saw a Chechen gunned down in the middle of Berlin in the end of 2019, Zelimkhan Khangoshvili. Turned out that the assassin was actually a criminal contract killer who had been hired by Russia's Federal Security Service for this mission. That's in some ways the more obvious. You'd think, well, of course, gangsters, they are for hire, they are amoral, they're always operating in the shadows, and they have, shall we say, a particular skill set that from time to time is going to be useful. And we've also seen the Chinese dealing with the Chinese triads and such like. But when I move to things like lawyers and financiers, again, you know, we're in a realm in which, you know, it's not as if a foreign intelligence service would approach a respected London or New York or wherever law firm and say, you know, hello, I am from this intelligence service and I would like to contract you. But we may well find that, you know, oligarchs and minigarchs, corporations and so forth, engage people, whether it's for lobbying, whether it's for moving money or whatever. And, you know, in today's, frankly, rather amoral, it's all about the business world, in many cases, people accept. So in this way, you know, you can hire publicists, you can hire all kinds of different people on the international market of talent. And so that, I think, is what's happened. And the gangsters are just simply, you might say, at the most extreme end of a whole spectrum of different services to which you can outsource your political conflicts these days.
Mm. Well, dwelling on this idea maybe of gangsters and outsourcing and taking it wider, Mark, what parts of conflict now, if any, are new versus old? Because, you know, some of what you said like reminds me of, say, just active measures during the Cold War, much older uses of mercenaries, deniable assets, and so on. Are there aspects of this which are very old, aspects of this which, you know, would be familiar to any historian of the 20th century? Are there parts of this also which are genuinely new and novel and you haven't seen before in kind of geopolitical competition?
I mean, I think in essence, the answer is no, this is not new. It's often got very, very dramatically new forms. I mean, there is this recurring conceit through the book that I draw parallels with the Italian Renaissance, a period where precisely you actually had, you know, countries that fought as much through culture and literature as actually through force of arms, and in which, in a way, everyone was everyone's ally today and everyone's ally enemy tomorrow. And so there was a very, very fluid politics at the time, which I think, again, is something that we're facing. But, you know, if one looks at all the various forms, you can track them all back. The thing is, though, that, I mean, obviously, you have very different kind of forms. You know, cyber particularly has introduced a whole new realm of opportunities to, put it bluntly, mess with other countries and seek to interfere with them and bend them to your will. But the human essence is all very, very familiar. It is essentially that, you know, whether it's in terms of mobilizing culture to try and sort of win soft power to get other countries to feel that they want to be like you and therefore will join your cause, whether it's in terms of, as I said, you know, undermining your enemy's capacity to feed themselves and, you know, their healthcare and everything else. Yes, now, once upon a time, you would do that by catapulting disease plague victims' bodies over the walls into an enemy city, or by ravaging the farmland outside of their city walls. Now you do it through, again, maybe it's embargoes on crops or, you know, other methods like that. So I think the forms have changed dramatically, but when it comes down to it, you know, conflict is, it has to be said, pretty fundamental to human nature. And societies and our polities you know, have had a lot of experience in how they conflict with each other. And so there aren't, I think, new ways to do it. In essence, there are very, very new forms.
Where is this going next then? So are there new battlefields? So if the idea of conflict is stretching and elasticating and essentially almost kind of burrowing its way into so many different parts of society and human organization, where do you see the new battlefields to be? You know, is the metaverse going to become maybe it already is a theater of conflict? You know, is crypto going to be wrapped into, confrontation between states? Where are the next places, Mark, that states are going to find to compete with one another in?
I mean, that's really the big question. And in some ways, let me answer it on kind of X and Y axes. I mean, in terms of kind of specific domains, I mean, all of those things that you mentioned can be weaponized. I mean, this is like, you know, one of the reasons why there is such a concern about the drive for quantum computing. You know, whoever can build these quantum computers that can do ridiculous numbers of calculations at a time can essentially crack all kinds of different forms of computer encryption, and that brings great power with it. So, I mean, yes, it's constantly been looking at for that new technological edge. There's going to be the new arenas. I mean, you know, once upon a time, cultural wars meant writing books and pamphlets saying how you were great and how the other country was pretty terrible and hoping you could smuggle them in. Then it moved into radio broadcasts. Now, absolutely, we are seeing it played out, whether it's in terms of the, you know, comments on articles or Twitter or Instagram or TikTok, indeed, as it's becoming increasingly, it seems, weaponized in this age. Everything is up for grabs. But I think, you know, to take the other angle, I think also where this is going is precisely this notion that all countries, and this is a very dystopian sounding situation, but in all countries are in some ways in a permanent state of, if not war, but conflict with all other countries. You know, because we do find, you know, friends do spy on friends, that they do compete often ruthlessly in economic competition. They do lean on each other during trade negotiations and everything else. And really the question will just simply be one of degree, that, you know, the relationships from time to time will be that much more harmonious and at other times will be that much more conflicted. But the point is that, in a way, it should always be seen on the spectrum. We still have this very old-fashioned, post-Westphalian binary notion that there is war and there is peace. And you have a war and then you resolve it and there is peace. Unfortunately not. We may well not be getting the real nasty hot wars in the main, thank God. But on the other hand, this idea that there will be this Elysian peace where everyone's actually happy with each other and friendly and cooperative, that isn't really the way the world is. So constant competition, exactly, all new technologies, all new domains will indeed be there. It's the same equivalent to the fact that anything can be criminalized. Whenever, you know, you have a new idea, a new situation, a new technology, someone will be thinking, how can I break the law and make money with this? Well, so too, everything can be weaponized. Someone in some state will be thinking, okay, you know, what particular opportunities does this give? That, unfortunately, is the nature of the modern world, in which actually the most weaponizable thing of all is ultimately going to be imagination.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year.
That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
So the great game, I guess, it has always felt to me very important, but also quite distant. You know, something which is happening with kind of great matters of state and diplomats and spies, usually in Vienna or perhaps Berlin. I guess what you're saying here is, or at least what I'm drawing from it is, you know, conflict's going to be constant. It's going to be ceaseless. It's going to be ubiquitous. And therefore, it's kind of going to turn up at all of our doorsteps, you know, normal people, really, that don't work for the Foreign Office. What does that mean? Like how might it change or touch our lives in ways that in the future that we might not know about? You know, are our companies going to somehow be wrapped into this? Are we going to perhaps become unwitting foot soldiers in some kind of geopolitical competition? Or do you see a lot of this to be passing us by largely unnoticed and our kind of daily lives actually remaining similar to how they as they were before?
Well, I mean, it'll probably pass unnoticed because we won't necessarily connect the dots. Classic example, I mean, we're speaking on the day when the energy price cap has been, it's been announced that it'll be going up. We're paying a lot more to heat our homes, and we're also paying a lot more for goods in the shops because of the knock-on effects. Well, part of the reason, and I don't want to make this sound as if this is all that nasty Mr. Putin did this to us, but you know, there's no way of getting around the fact that part of the reason why at present gas prices are ridiculously high is because of the impact of the geopolitical struggle that's currently taking place between Russia, which doesn't supply us with a lot of gas, but supplies Europe, and that affects prices overall. And therefore, that you know, that there is a, you know, the Russians clearly are happy to squeeze. And at the same time, the Americans have been lobbying very hard to stop the opening of a new gas pipeline, Nord Stream 2, to Germany from Russia, in part because The Germans want to be selling their expensive liquid natural gas. You know, I mean, so these are kind of, on the one level, absolutely very top level, great game kind of issues. But they have an impact every time you switch your radiator on. So, I mean, that's one example of the way that, you know, like it or not, we are constantly being faced with this. Just as on a positive level, in many ways, it's conflict that drives technological change. And it's not necessarily intended to be for our use, but we become the beneficiaries. We're talking over the internet, which, you know, one of the drivers behind the connection and the growth of the internet was precisely trying to create a secure distribution system which could survive nuclear war. So, you know, I think we will see both positive and negative impacts because of this. And again, here I'm going to sound a little bit like Michael Gove with his new Leveling Up paper commenting about the Medici effect. But actually, just as the Renaissance was a period of phenomenal cultural, economic, and technological innovation and change, so too, I think we will find exactly that this era of competition will only accelerate the current technological and social changes that are taking place. So again, this is it. Although, you know, I may have written about the weaponization of everything, but it's not all bad.
All right. Well, on that balance note, then let's move to audience questions. So it's your turn, everyone. Enough from me to ask Mark whatever you like. The first one from Ewan, thank you, which I think is a great question here, which kind of wonderfully moves us actually towards responses, which we haven't really had a chance to talk about much. So Ewan from London asks you, Mark, which elements of Western society are recognising the book's message, which are not but should be?
We see a lot of different groups, interests and so forth recognising elements of the problem. But I think this is the thing. Actually, they focus on the very, very specific one. One talks to police and counterintelligence officers, and they're very well aware, for example, about the use of gangsters as increasingly a tool of geopolitics. But that's what they're focusing on. You talk to people who are interested in macroeconomics, and they talk about manipulation of the markets, and particularly China being in a position increasingly to throw its weight around and use that as a political tool. So, you know, we have people who have visions of narrow spectra, parts of the spectrum. What we don't have, and this unfortunately is going to be really as much anything else a task for our political leadership, is people who are going to put it all together. People who are going to say, it's not that we actually have a gangsters and geopolitics problem and shifting focus of economic power and, you know, China controlling rare earths that are going to be vital for cell phone technology. And, you know, these are not all individual problems. These are all the aspects of a changing environment. So I think that for me is the big issue. It's not that any of these are something that no one has thought of before, but they haven't necessarily realized that what they're holding is actually just one part of the jigsaw.
Okay, well, Maria from Birmingham, next question, actually does dwell on this issue of linkedness and connectedness. So she says, you said that civil wars are still a big part of modern conflict, but have things changed now where hostile powers like Russia are able to encourage civil war, for instance, in the US, by manipulating social media? So she's very much, I think, kind of perhaps posing a slight challenge to you, Mark, on the connection between hybrid and grey zone war and actually how that might bubble back up into conventional conflict of different kinds.
Yeah, no, it's really important. And again, I think, you know, if we look at modern civil wars, it's very, very rare for them not to have foreign involvement, one or the other side being sort of supported by outside powers. So this is it. There is always a blurring there. But specifically on that point about sort of generating civil wars, this actually speaks to a really interesting, huge debate, which is really about disinformation and misinformation, and actually how effective it really is. And look, this is still an area that's being debated, and it's still an area in which the research is being done. But at present, what it really seems to show is that these kinds of foreign outside attempts to manipulate opinion, what they can do is they radicalize. They can't change. They can't take someone who, you know, today thought that the European Union was great and through magical mind control powers turn them into an ardent Brexiteer. But what they can do is take someone who was actually just a bit disgruntled, didn't really like the European Union, didn't really know much about it, but perhaps didn't think it was great, but who quite possibly wouldn't have bothered voting. and convince them. In fact, this is a really important issue, and it's, you know, essential about the existential nature of, you know, of Britain as a sovereign country. And that's why you absolutely have to go out and vote. And so that is generally the pattern we have seen, that what, and it's not just Russian, but, you know, what generally these kind of influence operations can do is actually they radicalize. And it's a term that we, you know, we tend to use radicalize in the context of terrorism. Well, actually, it has a much, much broader sort of sense. And that is where I think that there is a very real problem. And although, you know, again, it's not going to create civil wars, but it can certainly worsen them. And then once they happen, then other countries can use all kind of other means of exacerbating them, whether it's providing weapons or providing political top cover or whatever else. So absolutely, it fits into this notion of our capacity to, as I say, perhaps rather kind of simplistically, mess with other countries. But the point is that tends to require, you know, that particular trajectory, it tends to require all the seeds to have been there. And if I can just very briefly conclude, to go back to, you know, the things that we can do about it. That's why I think it's so important that we acknowledge that one of the things that we have to do in our societies is not just demonize and isolate those communities that feel marginalized. We have to find ways of integrating them, because otherwise they are precisely the weak link in our societal chain.
Well, the next question keeps us on the topic of disinformation, which I will actually at the end shamelessly editorialise on slightly myself. So the next questioner asks, why is it wrong for Western nations to retaliate with disinformation campaigns of their own in countries like Russia and China, who are currently attacking democracies with disinformation? That's the question. My own thought to append to that is, we know that Western countries have built capability for cyber operations, we know they've built capability for information operations as well. And it seems to me striking, Mark, and I like any thoughts you have on it, that we haven't published really in any way, it seems to me, a kind of rules of engagement for the information space. And that seems to be an absolute prerequisite for any military and any liberal democracy to feel like they can act in that space at all. And I wonder whether in the world of information warfare, that's a kind of strange example of where conventional militaries are actually acting outside of the laws of war, as it were, and therefore feeling like there's much less that they can do because they don't know what's allowable, what's permissible, mm-hmm. and what they have kind of sign off from society, in a sense, to be able to do.
Yeah, it's really important. I mean, again, that's unfortunately the kind of question that I could give a 40-minute answer for, but I'll try and give a 4-minute one. I mean, in terms of why shouldn't Western societies do that back? Well, I mean, on a moral level, I mean, why not? There is a practical issue, though, is that precisely authoritarian regimes tend to be that much more capable of resisting it because they tend to have more censorship. The media is heavily or entirely state controlled. It's a much harder target to use for disinformation. So, I mean, the question is, in part, whether it really makes sense to do it rather than anything else. But more broadly, I mean, again, I think at the moment we are still trapped in our notion of ourselves as we are the good guys. You know, we don't do disinformation. We do strategic communication, which I have a tendency to feel is what we call propaganda when we are doing it. The fact of the matter is, again, there is a moral and tactical choice to be made. And in some ways, I think this is played out by what happened, particularly from the American radio stations that broadcast into the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact through the period of the Cold War, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. Now, initially, they were heavily controlled and covered by the CIA. They were disinformation instruments. But what they came to realize is that, in fact, the most effective way of undermining these regimes was not to basically counter regime lies with Western lies, but instead to try and counter them with truth. That was the most corrosive thing. Once they got, and I think actually this is an area where it has to be said, the BBC World Service, Russian service, was extraordinarily influential, because people reached the point where they would believe the BBC over Pravda, Izvestia, and all the other instruments of Soviet state propaganda. So I think the other answer about, you know, why do we not use disinformation is, do we really want to go down that route? Once we go down that route, then unfortunately that there is a risk that we lose what is actually, I would suggest, one of our very real edges, which is precisely that we are liberal, democratic, transparent, law-based states. if we start playing by the rules of the authoritarian regimes, not only are we moving into a battle space where they have had the advantage, but we are giving up one of our own key strengths. And just to finally, I'm bringing it back to the business of the soldiers, you know, people like the 77th Brigade, whom you've written about. I mean, yes, I think this is one of the problems that at present, political understandings about conflict are lagging behind the technological capacities. And no one wants to be the one, I think, who comes up and says, these are the circumstances in which, for example, we are willing to lie to publics, because that would have to be part of any such discussion. And again, I would hope that at some point we have political masters who are willing to actually grasp those particular nettles and say, however uncomfortable, we need to talk about this and we need to do something about it.
Mark, the next question is taking us from perhaps an area of apparent high ground to one where many people feel the UK could do better, and that's the amount of dirty money can be swirling around in London. So the next question is, do you think Britain will ever crack down on dirty money in London, or are politicians too dependent on the cash? So also, I guess, party donations making an appearance there as well.
Sure. You see, it's not just politicians. I mean, I'm certainly not saying that isn't a factor. It's actually more that there is a whole realm of facilitators. I mean, in some ways, it's not actually, I think, the politicians really who are driving this. It's the banks, it's the lawyers, it's the estate agents who handle these multi-million pound penthouse purchases and such like, who are very good at lobbying and very good at trying to ensure that nothing gets cracked down on there. And more broadly, it is the fact that, yes, London is one of the great money launderers of the world. Now, we've got to realize what kind of money laundry it is. You know, you turn up with a suitcase full of cocaine-stained $100 bills, and they will call the police. However, if you wear a nice suit and you have had the courtesy to pre-wash the money through a half dozen different jurisdictions before, so it's bounced from Bogota to Belize to the British Virgin Islands, Israel, Cyprus, Latvia, and then comes, then you'll be welcome with open arms, because that is the nature of the economic model. But in fairness, I mean, where are the other great hubs of money laundering in the world? New York, Dubai, Frankfurt. I mean, unfortunately, that's the nature of modern finance. We absolutely could do a lot more. And I think that, you know, we're now beginning to get real pressure to do that, particularly things like beneficial ownership. So you can actually know who honestly owns this building or that company. I mean, that's an area which really we can do a lot more. Do I think we're going to actually see any real change? I mean, I suspect so. And in some ways, it's obviously what's going on at the moment with Russia that is driving it, because we have this concern that Russian money is somehow influenced. The thing is, I see no evidence that the amount of questionable or downright dirty Russian cash, which is in the UK, has in any way really affected policy. We've got to remember that actually, you know, if one looks at, for example, Europe, I mean, the UK and Poland are the countries that absolutely stand out in terms of the very strong line they've taken against Russia. You know, if this is after Russian influences have been brought to bear and whatever, I think actually what oligarch money does is it buys you the kind of influence that means you're invited to all the best parties. And when you want to build a new underground swimming pool or a helipad, then you get your planning permission quickly. It's that kind of personal capital that it really gets. But because we're worried about it, it'll drive the process. And whatever laws are brought in to essentially try and address Russian dirty money will, I trust, also be applied to Chinese and Nigerian and Indian and, yes, American and Swedish and everyone else's dirty money, because we're all involved in this. But I think it really takes that kind of specific case that shocks and startles and forces political change to really get us moving. You know, we would not be having the debate that we have at the moment about Russian dirty money were it not for what's happening in Ukraine and how, you know, Russia generally is launching this kind of covert political war against Britain and the rest of the West. And sort of likewise, it'll probably take some other kind of specific shock to force more movement? Because, yeah, at the moment, unfortunately, the bankers, the lawyers, the estate agents, and the politicians, they all have an incentive in talking tough, but not acting.
Well, the next question, Mark, brings us on to another absolutely fascinating theme, actually, which we haven't had a chance to discuss, which is the kind of interactions between corporation and competition. So talking tough, acting tough, but then also actually working with, you know, the whole panoply of actors which are out there and surround us too. So the questioner asks, if we're all locked into competition, do you think it's fanciful to think that we could come together to halt something like climate change?
I mean, climate change is a really sort of difficult one, obviously, because it's a sort of huge issue. But, you know, what's really striking is even despite this current very, very tough East-West tension, when we had the recent COP26 summit, the Russians sent actually a bit last minute, but they sent a really quite high power delegation and they genuinely engaged. And, you know, the person, one of the people there was Putin's personal advisor on ecological affairs. Likewise, I mean, we have obviously Russian hackers running wild across the West. Sometimes they're just purely criminal hackers. Sometimes they're criminal hackers who you might say have a certain degree of top cover from the security authorities that just want to say, look, as long as you're hitting the West, that's fine. And sometimes they're clearly actually just simply employees of the Russian intelligence community. At the same time, though, just a couple of weeks ago, we had a major series of arrests against a hacking group in Russia called R-Evil, which was involved in a series of ransomware attacks in the United States. Now, maybe in part the Russians were doing that because the Americans asked and they wanted to sort of publicly show good faith. But it's also because actually the Russians themselves have started to get really quite worried about cybercrime. Because actually Russia is in many ways a very advanced society. I mean, it has the same levels of internet penetration and usage as the UK. You know, very extensive use of e-government as well as e-banking and e-commerce sort of facilities, which basically means there's a lot of opportunities for the criminals. And they're now finding themselves being attacked not only by Russian hackers, but Western hackers and, although they don't like to talk about it too much, Chinese hackers. So even in the midst of, you know, a kind of confrontation that is seeing, you know, American and British forces being flown to reinforce NATO's flank and weapons being sent to the Ukrainians precisely to kill Russians, to put it bluntly, if the Russians escalate, even amidst that crisis, we're still talking about genuine climate change progress. Slow, but genuine. And there is still room for law enforcement cooperation. I mean, one last example, again, because I, you know, travel quite a lot to Moscow and, you know, from time to time I talk to Western police liaison officers who are based in embassies there. And one of the things they're saying, you know, what's really striking is that regardless of the political situation, paedophilia cases, never any problem. Those zoom through. So I think this is the interesting thing. As we get used to this idea that we are in constant competition, but also constant opportunities for collaboration, we will find these interesting constellations whereby we can be absolutely daggers drawn in various arenas, but find common interests in others. That, I think, is exactly the nature of this very, very complex and dynamic and fluid world that we face.
Are these areas where states as states find common ground in the face of a series of forces which many might see as actually undermining the power of states? So I guess a lot of what you've been talking about is kind of almost like states adapting to a new world where, you know, actually in many ways states are struggling to express power. You know, it might be because cybercrime is extremely difficult for them to deal with and enforce, or it might be because all kinds of transnational flows of money and people are meaning that borders and geography are becoming less important. In a way, can we see cooperation in those terms, Mark, as kind of states being like, oh my God, like we really are being undermined as entities here. Like we need to work together to kind of re-express, you know, in a way, our own power as states back onto the world.
It's a really interesting question. I mean, I think there is an element of that. Again, I think some states are much more aware of this than others, I feel. But precisely in some ways, it is the states which are more aggressive, assertive, use whichever word you want, in trying to exercise power, that also have come to realize all the more carefully the limitations of traditional state power. whether it's in terms of transnational corporations that can decide whose tax regime they fall under and who actually it's very difficult to control. I mean, you know, again, here's an obvious example. You know, the Russians have increasingly been having trouble trying to influence tech giants with social media platforms. And try and force them to, you know, comply with Russian law. And to a degree, it's an emotive way of putting it, but in some ways they're having to almost resort to hostage taking in the sense that they say, we'll prosecute your employees in our country for decisions made by your head office if you do not comply. And this is fine up to a point, until the point when Google or whoever decide, well, you know, we're just going to pull our guys out of Russia, but Russians can continue to access our sites and so forth. And that forces the Russians to then think, how can we block that? And so forth. It becomes very difficult. So yes, I mean, I think that states are finding it difficult. And one of the interesting areas, you know, we have a tendency to have this kind of slightly sort of cyberpunkish corporations, mega corporations and states binary kind of contest. But it's actually also what we might think of as human communities, which I think are one of the areas that is really interesting, because nowadays, you know, people can connect and maybe you're part of some kind of gaming clan, or maybe you just simply are the people who follow some particular Instagram feed and engage with an influencer or whatever. But, you know, the opportunity for people to interact with each other in ways that are pretty much entirely, I mean, short of cutting off the internet, pretty much entirely outside the control of the state. I mean, that's becoming increasingly interesting. And I think one of the new big issues is, you know, people who are able to mobilize that. People who are able to take, well, you know, I've got 25 million fans around the world, and I'm now going to tell them, whether it's to lobby government or to use this particular product or just simply not to do whatever. You know, that I think is something that states are already clearly sort of concerned about, because that's not something that they're used to facing, and they don't have the clear instruments to deal with this thing. So yes, again, going back to this earlier point about new forms of power emerging and power that is largely sort of locused outside the state structures, and states working out either how can we hijack them, how can we co-opt them, how can we control them, and if need be, how can we eliminate them, but always with that slightly uncomfortable sense of, but there's probably a limit to what we can do.
We've spoken about Putin somewhat. So let's talk about strongmen in general for a second. I think especially interesting, given the kind of recent threats in Ukraine around direct sanctioning of Putin and members of his family, as I understand it. Where does strong men or women, Mark, sit in the hybrid war or the grey zone? Are they going to be increasingly kind of targeted kind of directly, perhaps, by, you know, this myriad of different mm-hmm. levers and sanctions and new ways of expressing conflict?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, again, they always have been. But again, there are new ways. Now, I mean, with someone like Putin, for example, despite all the talk about the fact he's, you know, richest man in the world and has money here and there everywhere, I mean, Putin's real power or his real wealth, shall we say, is his political power. I mean, he doesn't need to buy anything. If he wants a new palace, as he did, he basically, you know, arranges for oligarchs who want to remain oligarchs to pony up to pay for it. That's his monetizable thing. He's not the kind of figure who is clearly sort of stashing money away in a Swiss bank account with the idea that one day he'll retire to an agreeable villa in, you know, sort of the Caribbean and go and play golf or whatever. There are other strongmen, clearly, who are very different, who precisely are motivated by stashing their money outside and, you know, are therefore much more vulnerable. But the interesting thing is about the sort of the strongman is also, I mean, strongmen, and I don't like that because often they're not very strong at all, really. But anyway, that kind of you know, single personalized authoritarian figure. The key thing is they are mythic figures. It's not just about the fact that Putin controls the key security apparatus and such like. It's also because he's managed to create for himself this persona, which is not the heavily Botoxed 69-year-old, but still the vigorous, dynamic, bare-chested man of action. And that is his vulnerability. Again, if we go back to, you know, the earlier question about the, you know, why do we not use disinformation? I mean, what is clear is that, for example, by amplifying, you know, videos of his exceedingly garish palace down on the Black Sea with its room with a pole dancing pole and all that kind of thing, and generally news about his corruption and such like, the West has indeed been actively trying to puncture part of his mythic persona. And we could do a lot more, to be perfectly honest. So I think this is the interesting thing, is that, yes, there will be some strong men for whom precisely going after their money will absolutely be the most efficient way of doing it. For others, it'll actually be about undermining their information control and breaking that through not necessarily disinformation, but quite possibly amplifying truths that are uncomfortable. But again, it's about looking for the individual instruments which will allow us to undermine or modify the behavior of that particular person. I remember once talking to a British spook who said that actually, you know, what he wished was they had the capability that they could basically hack into Putin's mobile phone. I don't actually think he uses a mobile phone, but anyway, that's not the point of the anecdote. Hack into his mobile phone and change the ringtone without him knowing until it rang, and to be able to do that every day, just to make that point, oh, we can reach out and do this to you. So, you know, I mean, even that, I mean, as a way of behavior modification, on one level, it's totally trivial. So that his phone plays Rule Britannia when it rings, instead of the Russian national anthem or whatever else. But in terms of psychological impact, that might be great. So again, you just pick the right instrument for the right target.
I was going to suggest people could tweet at us what their best idea for Putin's ringtone, were that ever to be possible. Well, maybe you could pass that on, Mark. But we've only got 3 minutes left. So final question. I'm sorry to everyone that I haven't managed to get to. Thank you so much for all of your wonderful questions. They were all brilliant. Mark, I'd like us to end it where we began, suitably enough, I think, about definition of warfare. So it's such a compelling picture you paint of this kind of ebb and flow of warfare from something which was big to something which was well-defined to something which is expanding again. I wonder whether you ever see a world now where almost like the definitional boundaries of warfare become reasserted. You know, might we ever see a backlash and kind of almost like restore the Westphalian conception of war and actually say, you know what, we need to put rules back around all of this and definitions back around all this, and continuous war isn't something which we are happy with? Or is this, at least for the duration now, likely to be the kind of world definitionally that we're going to live in?
I mean, in many ways, I would love to think that we could see that return to that notion. But first of all, I mean, one of the key problems is so many of the new instruments of war fighting are hard to attribute. I mean, you know, if it's a cyber attack, you can be pretty certain where it came from, but you can never, it's very, very hard to actually say for certain that came from that computer and it was done because of that reason. In a way that if a plane flies off from an airfield and drops a bomb on you, you can be rather more confident. So I think that's one of the key problems. And it's already that there's talk, for example, about a cyber treaty at the United Nations, and they're already running into real problems about this. So one is it's hard to do so. Secondly, again, yes, the Westphalian order was fine, but as I said, our experience of the Cold War was actually what that meant was the haves agreed rules against each other. And I'm very much minded of the time when a British gunner had Napoleon in his sights at the Battle of Waterloo. And the Duke of Wellington said that, you know, basically generals do not war on other generals. You know, blow away as many soldiers as you want, but you don't go after the general. Well, likewise, I think actually even the old order was that rich countries obeyed the rules and they fought their dirty rules-breaking wars in other people's countries. I don't think we want to go back to that.
Well, on that note, Mark, thank you so much. This has been Mark Galeotti, everyone. His brilliant new book, The Weaponization of Everything, A Field Guide to the New Air War, is out. Everyone, thank you so much for all your brilliant questions and for coming and for listening to this Intelligence Squared event.